Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian news conversation demonstrating that Gen X cultural references need not be limited to Super Bowl Sunday. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hi, sports ballers.
Hey, Matt.
Valentine's howdy.
Happy Valentine's Day.
It's Valentine's Day. Catherine, Peter, I just got to ask, I got to sucker punch you from the beginning. Did you indeed give in to your American birthright and watch the Super Bowl, or do you even know what I'm talking about?
I read a New York Times article about the Dr. Dre show the morning after the Super Bowl.
You're the worst. Oh, I am God. A good American.
Did you watch the Dr. Dre show? It was, it was Snoop Dogg, but it was really Dre's show. It was fantastic.
I went to a Super Bowl party. I brought beer and pigs in a blanket.
Oh.
I watched one half of the Super Bowl. And by watched it, I mean mostly I yelled at my children and the other children who were trying to kill a dog at the party. We all sat down for the halftime show, and I had the quintessential generational experience where all the olds were like, this show is banging. We love it. We were super into it. And all of the kids were like, we don't know who these people are. This is boring. And it was
why
like,
are they so fat?
I got old. Yesterday, I got old. That was the day.
Dr. Dre definitely needs to go on Slim Fast.
50 Cent.
He's doing fine. He doesn't need advice from you, frankly.
I don't know. You know what? Like, in terms of BMI, I think I got him beat. Doctor to doctor. You know what was great about that, by the way, Matt, since as long as we're talking about football and halftime shows, it like the Prince halftime show from 2007, 2006, it was a very generous show where everybody was doing kind of everybody else's music. Mm-hmm. And I found it really fantastic. And it was like the best Eminem performance I've seen in probably decades. I liked it. I wanted more Snoop Dogg, but
everybody wants more Snoop Dogg.
Better than his random appearance at the Oscars a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it was, absolutely.
For those of you who were worried that the distraction of the Super Bowl would be used as a cover to launch an all-out shooting war between the United States and Canada, last night at the stroke of midnight, but probably not, but why not? Let's just say it. The Ambassador Bridge linking Windsor, Ontario, and Detroit, Michigan was once again freed up for traffic after being snarled by protesting truckers for nearly one full week. That bridge allegedly carries one quarter of U.S.-Canada trade. So let's talk about this a little bit. The trucker protests began more than 2 weeks ago now. We've talked about it, I think, on consecutive broadcasts here. It started to protest vaccine mandates and passports for long-haul drivers north of the border. They are still paralyzing the Canadian capital of Ottawa, with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau reportedly and repeatedly portraying demonstrators as part of a kind of racist lunatic fringe. Meanwhile, they have spurred copycat freedom convoy protests, including Le Convoy de Liberté in France, Paris, Brussels, and London, The Hague. Wellington, New Zealand has freedom convoy protests. And elsewhere, there are 1,000 different interesting subplots to pursue here, Catherine. But first, I think you in particular will share my relief that the crisis has been averted. And by the crisis, I mean really bad American journalists tweeting about how they would resolve by force the dispute on the Ambassador Bridge of how to get 18-wheelers off of it. But I'm struck by the comparatively simple solution that seems to have always been out there about this, which is kind of spoken to or given voice to by a quote from yesterday from one of the leaders of the protests in Ottawa, who says, the difficult read there, that quote, end the mandates, end the passports. That is why we are here. Is that so hard, Catherine?
Well, I mean, it would definitely have been easier and probably more successful to do that a hot minute ago, because this seems like many of protests in recent memory, especially these kind of civil disobedience, Occupy style protests, to have now metastasized into a protest about a lot of things. I think many of us read the piece in the Barry Weiss Substack by somebody who went and kind of hung out with the truckers and asked them why they were there. And it had very much the feel of the reporting that came out of the BLM demonstrations, which was people have a bunch of complaints. And this was the thing that kind of got them out and got them together. And also, similarly, that because this was kind of a decentralized movement, there's not, you know, one hostage negotiator. There's not one person who can be like, great, our demands have been met, and now we stand down and return things to the status quo.
It's also kind of like Occupy Wall Street in that sense.
Yep. This and is obviously a model that has come, you know, has emerged before. But, you know, I think it's actually not quite as simple as that, right? Like, even if they repealed the mandate tomorrow for the truckers, it's not clear that any of this would really go away. This has now become just kind of a protest of all complaints. And of course, that always means that at some point when the protest gets big enough and diverse enough, you get a Nazi and then everyone loses their minds.
Sudman, building on that, like the jack of all complaints, right? A model here, there's been a lot of fanciful kind of journalistic theories on the increase recently. I think I read in the Guardian that it was a QAnon conspiracy, maybe founded by the Koch brothers. It's all south of the border. This dark money, like this, everyone wants to come up with a really crazy, far-reaching explanation for all this. And again, it seems to me that there might be a more simple thing on our hands, which J.D. Tuccilli wrote about to great and hilarious extent this morning on thereason.com website, which is a very good website you should refresh constantly, which is that it seems to me that the people who have been advocating for government mandates about whatever things, masks or your shop does this, or yeah, you have to have a vaccine, have always throughout this pandemic either discounted or just plain, you know, disregarded that when you use government force, it creates conflict.
Yes. I think that, you know, as I've said many times on this podcast, I am very much in favor of everyone or just about everyone getting vaccinated, but I am also opposed to broad-based government-enforced mandates. And one of the reasons why, one of the big reasons why, is that I just think they are counterproductive to encouraging people to get vaccinated. If you want people to get vaccinated, the way to do that is to try to persuade them. It's not going to work on everyone. And that kind of brings us to what I think is sort of the deeper underlying problem here, which is the political establishment on the left writ large. And that's not just in the United States, that's in Canada and in Europe and kind of across the Western world right now, does not want to engage in meaningful persuasion with a lot of ideas that they just view as simply unacceptable. And so what they have done is just say, look, you're not allowed to hold that position. Oh, wait, you hold that position still? We're going to pass a law that says you can't do that. We're going to pass a law that says you're not allowed to believe that. You're not allowed to speak it. You're not allowed to put that on Facebook. It's misinformation. It's disinformation. And what that has done is to radicalize a lot of people against in some cases what I think are basically sensible views about vaccination and other things. And there is a problem right now in political discourse, and this is true on the left and on the right, but it is particularly true in the United States and in Canada on the left, where the left has power, which is that there is a big part of the kind of lefty political establishment that just doesn't want to accept that people are going to have diverging views, that people are going to think differently about vaccines, about masks, about quarantines, stay-at-home orders and the like, right? All this sort of post-COVID petty rulification of society, right? And they're going to respond to that with this weird blend of neuroticism and like incredibly small ball, in many cases, authoritarianism, where every single individual activity and private human interaction has to be approved and turned into a safety checklist by the state, right? Is it okay to go to the park with a mask on or without a mask on? Check with the CDC, right? Like that sort of thing. And I think there's a lot of people who find that bizarre and who just don't like that. And yet, that sense that that is wrong and that is a weird way to organize society is being treated as as something monstrous, as something that's simply unacceptable in public discourse. And I think when that happens and when people in power try to use force to prevent that, you end up with scenes like we are seeing with the Canadian truckers.
You know, Matt, I would second what Peter's talking about, point people also to the former CIA analyst and current Mercatus Center visiting scholar Martin Gurry. Wrote a book called The Revolt of the Public and the Crisis of Authority in the New Millennium, which is, you know, predicts exactly what is going on in this case. He was talking in the wake of the Tea Party and Occupy and the beginning of the Black Lives Matter movement. The book was originally published in 2014 and then was revised in 2018. But there is a widespread lack of trust and confidence in government. I've written a lot about this. Other people at Reason have. And the response of government, whether it's right wing or left wing, has been to kind of triple down on the policies that keep people from actually feeling represented or heard. I think there's a huge class element in a lot of these things. The Tea Party movement, to a certain degree, had a class element to it where it was middle class people, but not of the elites. This truck driver convoy, it matters that it's truckers who feel kind of simultaneously that they are the backbone of the economy. They are the ones who are delivering the goods, you know, literally and figuratively, but nobody takes them seriously. Nobody cares about what they go through. According to the Canadian Trucking Alliance, something like 87% of truckers are already vaccinated. So it isn't about the vaccine mandate per se, even if that's the touch point. And I think, you know, governments need to recognize this as well as other elites, and that includes people in business and organized religion and whatnot. This is not going away. And the trucker convoy, I think of it in terms of the Tea Party, which was also at its most ferocious, was leaderless, and kind of articulate in its rage, but incapable of actually coming up with a program to achieve the ends that it kind of announced that it wanted. I think that's going to happen.
Well, they did want all the government money out of their Medicare.
Yeah. No, but I mean, it's not, you know, these are not coherent movements, but the rage and resentment is meaningful. Right. And the main message of the Tea Party was stop spending so much. In the blink of an eye, it was absorbed into the Republican Party after electing half a dozen people, including, you know, many libertarian leaning Republicans, and spending, you know, only continued to grow, you know, at much, much faster rates. You know, so I think that's something that's going on here. And Gurry, again, in The Revolt of the Public, talks about how these movements are very good at using contemporary technology to kind of articulate rage, resentment, and dissatisfaction, but they really are incapable of, you know, having the kind of social impact that one might think they want. And it's interesting to, you know, compare them to something like the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s, which was made up of a vast array of different organizations, but they were definitely not leaderless. And when you go back and you read the history of how the Birmingham bus boycott was ended, and the way that the NAACP and other groups did work to make it look like it was a spontaneous revolt, it was actually very, very carefully crafted and orchestrated. And that isn't the kind of protest movements we're getting now. So we get the rage and then kind of either the dissipation of the rage or the you know, it just gets kind of agglomerated into the power structure. And then, you know, we start with another protest in 2 years or 5 years.
And because it is decentralized, that does have the effect of drawing in some people with, I think it's fair to say, fringy and strange views. And so those views then get amplified in many cases, right, you know, by critics. But this, again, is why you don't pursue vaccination and other things through mandates, is because what you're going to do is have the effect of that is going to be to give people with some of those fringy views and some time something to sort of grab onto and to hold onto. And it is going to have the effect of organizing those people. And you know, there are, I think, quite sympathetic ways to look at the trucker protests. But like I said, there are also some, you know, sort of, there are some oddball views that are part of that. But you can stop all of this from happening by saying up front that the way we are going to approach vaccination is not to say you have to be vaccinated, instead to say, here's why vaccination is a very good idea for you and your family.
I agree with that, but I think it misses the point of the, you know, the big protest movements, including, you know, things like the Women's March, you know, Occupy, Tea Party, Black Lives Matter. There's a precipitating cause, but it's, you know, the ball of gas that is being ignited is this long simmering sense of, you know, of a large group of people who feel incredibly disenfranchised and not listened to. And so this time it was vaccine mandates, and it obviously would have been better not to have had them and to more fully participate in the persuasion you're talking about. But it's going to be something else, because the way elites and the way governments are working throughout Western Europe and the kind of OECD world, you know, it is this distant group of people who know best. I mean, it's not quite the Hunger Games yet, but it's getting there, where the ruling class has fully separated and they don't give a shit what the people they supposedly represent think about anything.
A couple of quotes kind of illustrating that, and I second Nick's recommendations of Martin Gurry's book, The Revolt of the Public, which is really great. Justin Trudeau has had a lot of just awful quotes to my ear disregarding these protests. One, we won't give in to those who fly racist flags. We won't cave to those who engage in vandalism. There is no place in our country for threats, violence, or hatred. Just painting with that kind of broad brush, that you could feel the condescension and just dripping from it. And then this, I only saw this because I was doing light preparation for this podcast. Is a piece in CNN. It wasn't one of those opinion pieces trolling for your attention that CNN and other news organizations sadly try to publish. But this is just straight news describing in the second or third paragraph what's happening. The protesters' demands do not reflect the majority view in Canada, which has one of the highest vaccination rates in the world, with about 4 in every 5 Canadians fully vaccinated. Hate crimes have soared since the protests started in Ottawa, and a dedicated hotline has been established in the city following reports of anti-Semitic, racist, and homophobic acts at the demonstration. The protests have been jumped on by the far right and COVID conspiracists around the world. That doesn't make me want to ever consume a piece of media from CNN again. Like, the condescension just kind of burns. Catherine, you watched the Super Bowl, which means that you were hanging out with a bunch of nice Northern Virginia ladies and their families, probably, or something like that. And so I'm wondering about the kind of Hunger Games aspect of seeing 100,000 maskless people in Los Angeles, including, the sort of Hollywood and political local elite dancing in the latest Remy video. There was an interview that President Biden did with Lester Holt that was broadcast, and Lester Holt pointed out that everyone there was violating local ordinance or whatever. And Biden says, I love how people talk about personal freedom. If you're exercising personal freedom, put someone else in jeopardy, their health in jeopardy, I don't consider that being very dealing with freedom. What's your
Matt,
reaction to the president?
Have you done a Vulcan mind meld with Joe Biden? Because sometimes it really sounds like you're a little woo boo.
It was very, very accurate. That answer was one among many, many answers in that interview, which were, they just trailed off. Like, over and over, he was asked the most predictable possible question. Hey, I'm doing a sit down with Lester Holt. What's he going to ask me about? Pretty clear list of stuff that Biden knew he was going to be asked about. And many of his answers, especially the COVID answers, were I don't know. Except for this one where he managed to pull out, people are wrong about freedom if they don't want to wear a symbolic cloth mask at the Super Bowl outdoors or semi-outdoors. I don't really understand how football stadiums work. But no, I thought that quote was absolutely horrific. And it embodied this mindset, which is, I think, increasingly common and unscrutinized, which is that somehow anything having to do with public health, there's a freedom exception. And that's not right. That's not right. It is not to say, I've said on this podcast before, I've written that I do think There is a case for some public health action in an airborne pandemic, but I don't think that someone not wearing a mask at the Super Bowl is any longer in the in that space, and maybe never was, based on what we now know about masking. And I think it's troublingly Manichaean that that is still where this kind of conversation is coming from the president of the United States. My Super Bowl watching crew is, you know, there are some variations, but I would say they are largely in the vaxxed and done category at this point. And not coincidentally, as you mentioned, are all parents of young children and would sure love to send their kids to school unmasked for 5 days a freaking week.
Catherine, just to ask, you said that your friends were vaxxed and done. Do they tend to be more liberal or conservative? Yeah.
Yeah. This crew is, you know, I am by far the most politically heterodox in this particular crew. We once almost destroyed, it's technically a book club because I am a white woman. We once almost destroyed the book club by trying to talk about guns, but we are surprisingly, or maybe at this point, I would say unsurprisingly, aligned on, you know, the idea that, you know, particularly in our kids' schools, in the places that we frequent, the vaccination rates are incredibly high and that the risks to kids always low are lower than ever. And that takes you to some natural conclusions, not just about what's going on in schools, but also about what risks people are allowed to take at the stupid Super Bowl.
So that Trudeau quote and the Biden quote and the CNN article are all really aggravating examples of trying to read people out of the discourse, right? Of simply saying that these views are not
just like
allowed to be
expressed. Slamming the Overton
right?
window on people's fingers, just like.
And this seems to be the preferred method of engagement for certainly there's some of this on the right too, but again, the left is who has power in, you know, sort of in journalism, in academia, certainly in Congress and the White House right now, is that they are trying to simply say that these views are not acceptable, rather than engage with real, if perhaps wrong, political and policy concerns. And I think part of the problem is that there is now this view that engagement signals agreement. That if you talk to these people, that means you have that you have some sympathy for their views, and that doesn't have to be true. Engagement does not have to signal agreement. Instead, what engagement signals is that you care. It shows that you are listening and that you see these people as having some dignity, even if you completely disagree with them. And on so many issues, that sort of signaling that you care and that you listen and that you are listening and that you think these people have some sort of like that their lives are valid is what isn't happening. And I think that is a big part of the problem with our political discourse. And we see that reflected in the trucker protests and so many other things.
I think, you know, Matt, I know you like to go back in time a bit. Part of what we're witnessing here, well, because Matt has now lived 1,000 lifetimes. He's in Joe Biden's consciousness. But if you go back to the 60s, there was a sense, and this was largely coming from youth. What's interesting now is actually that a lot of the revolt is actually coming from older people rather than younger people. But the whole student movement in the 60s, particularly the free speech movement coming out of Berkeley and whatnot, was explicitly talking about how, like, I don't want to be a number, you know, in a draft card. I don't want to have a student number at Berkeley. I don't want to be treated as an integer in somebody else's computer program of the world. Mario Savio, the leader of that, talked about throwing your, you know, there are times when you have to throw your body on the machine to stop it from operating. I'm sensing a lot of that again. And that was coming out of a post-war consensus that the best and the brightest, you know, the smart guys, you know, who could run GM or Ford Motors, you know, Robert McNamara went from, you know, heading up the Edsel project to becoming, you know, eventually Secretary of Defense during Vietnam. He was a bright guy. He didn't need a lot of input because he had all the computing power he needed in his head and, you know, with his slide rule and stuff. And that led to massive revolts on all, you know, in all sorts of ways. And I think we're seeing something like that. What is different is that, you know, it's not driven by youth. In many ways, youth now is so kind of conformist and pliable and constantly appealing to authority to sort things out. But this makes me actually a little bit excited, more excited now than I was in the morning. before this, because I was like, you know, you talk about how, you know, I have to engage you guys, and that means people might think I agree with you, and you know, it's just very hard every week. But I think it's exciting, because you know what needs to happen next, though, is what is the framework that comes after this? Because you have, you know, to Peter's point, you have the slimmest possible Democratic majority in the Congress, and they are acting as if they are, you know, 99-1, and they're not. So this is, it's not sustainable the way the elites are kind of running things now, but that framework for what comes next has not appeared yet. And that's, you know, maybe that's what really, what libertarians should be working on.
I feel like the thing that really showed the way was the Boston Dynamics ad during the Super Bowl, where the cleaning crew, or the security crew of the Sam Adams factory, and the robots from Boston Dynamics had a dance party together and drank beers. And that is the vision of social harmony that I personally endorse. The counter document, I guess, to it was the Planters nut ad.
Yeah, always disturbing. Yeah.
People fighting over whether you should eat mixed nuts individually or whether you should eat them by the handful. And the tagline at the end of the ad was like, oh, who knew Americans could get really mad about like a very small disagreement?
As if the peanut allergy schism hasn't already divided America.
First of all, yes, yeah. Peanut allergy erasure in that ad for sure. But just the fact that like both of these ads were like trying to like make lighthearted fun of the fact that it does really seem like people think that people who disagree with them are monsters who should be killed.
You know what's amazing, though, too, is that at the same, I was going to say, like, at the same time, people can live their own lives. Like, they're more empowered than ever to just kind of get through the day, which is great. And I think they feel that, and that's why they get pissed off at mandates of all sorts. But then the flip side of that is that we really have over the past, certainly over the past 10 years and really longer than that, we have cultivated a dependence on government where, you know, 50% or more of households now are getting some kind of direct transfer, you know, at various points from government. So this, in many ways, is the worst of all possible worlds. To go back to what Peter was saying during the Tea Party protest, you know, people having signs saying, keep the government out of my Medicare. And for those who don't realize, Medicare is a government-funded healthcare program for old people. That's kind of writ large, and disentangling that is probably going to cause as much friction as we're seeing just, you know, kind of directed at leaders right now.
I think pursuant.
Nick asks, what's the next model for political engagement? And it just made me think, you know who talks to people and who engages at length with a lot of different ideas and perspectives?
The recent interview with Nick Gillespie?
Rogan.
Oh, I'm
Joey Tomato.
Well, is the recent interview with Nick Gillespie, but also is Joe Rogan, right? And that makes him very popular as a filter and for political discussion. And that also makes him the enemy to the discourse police.
I would also just add, pursuant to Nick's question, politically, we are seeing, or governmentally, we are seeing the next step being taken basically by mostly governors. Democratic governors in particular, who can read a poll, and the polls are that Catherine's friends are in a majority at this point, the vaxxed and done, and want to go in a different direction. And it was Governor Phil Murphy of New Jersey who narrowly lost re-election, re-election.
Joe Biden.
And no one was
Matt Biden.
Come on, Bill, better back. and he was the one who's leading the governors. They were pressuring the CDC and saying, hey, look, can you change the rules in the local parks in Peter's formulation? You know, so many of blue states that voted for Biden have basically cut and pasted CDC recommendations for COVID, and CDC is still telling, you know, pregnant women not to drink a glass of wine, or even ladies in general not to drink more than two, which is just hate speech.
Or vessels, Matt, for the future. We have no choice but to stay healthy per CDC recommendations.
But so. We should subsidize you.
But
sure,
right?
I accept.
That was a good New York Times piece about a week ago, saying he just grew exasperated at this and realized we have to move fast. And now there's been a bit of a domino effect. mostly in blue states, joining where red states have been for more than a year, which is something, speaking of erasure, that happens constantly in these conversations. Like, we all talk about as if the country is masked at schools. There's only 6 states left that have school mandates, masking mandates on the books. Sadly, I live in one of them, but those things are falling by the wayside. It's not going to erect a new architecture of discourse and politics and policy, but at least that's how those things go away. Before we leave the topic, I wanted to just point to a Twitter feed of a guy named Aaron Ginn. I don't know if I've ever met him or not. He's in the Lincoln Network. It's at A-G-I-N-N-T. And all he's been doing, it's an interesting follow, is he posts a video of COVID protests all over the world every day, and has been doing it for a long time. And a thing that you get by looking at it is you realize that America has had comparatively few. They've been protesting in France from the jump, as soon as the vaccine mandate and passport. Oh God,
they were even before that, right? Yellow Jackets are still, protesting.
It doesn't take much to get a Frenchman to burn a sheep, that is for sure. It is very interesting, and I wonder if the dispersed nature of our governance, especially in schools, we don't have the New Zealand press the button, you're all locked down mechanisms here yet. Thank God. So I wonder if that's sort of blocking things up. Okay, speaking of blocking things up, sorry to talk so long. We're going to get to our listener email, which continues some of this conversation here in a second. But first, tired of that siren? Tired of feeling like someone's always watching you on the internet? IPVanish VPN is here to protect your right to privacy and to help you stay anonymous online. IPVanish helps you safely browse the internet without exposing your private details to third parties such as hackers, your ISP, or advertisers. You can use IPVanish on your computer, tablet, phone, even streaming gizbots like Fire Stick. I know what that is. Using IPVanish means all your data is encrypted. Passwords, communications, browsing history, everything will be completely shielded from other people's eyes. Even your physical location will be hidden. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. It's that simple. Right now, IPVanish is offering an incredible 70% off their yearly plan for Reason Roundtable listeners with a 30-day money-back guarantee. That's like getting 9 months free. Here's what you do. Go to IPVanish.com/roundtable and use the promotional code roundtable and start getting invisible. That's IPVanish.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Keep sending your pithy queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Dan Sherwood. I think I can pronounce that one, who writes in part, "My vaccination status notwithstanding, I am mandate hesitant." Well done, Dan. "And am reluctant to trust Doctors Fauci and Walensky most of the time. I would like to hear the panel's thoughts on the Johns Hopkins meta-analysis report that was released last week, indicating lockdowns had provided a 0.2% effect on mortality and suggesting they should be avoided to combat this virus. My frustration is that this report was virtually buried by most left-leaning media and probably oversimplified by the right. Does the panel think this study should have got more play, or did it have flaws in their analysis? Thanks for your time." Peter, you read studies for breakfast. What say you?
Oh man, and this one was delicious. I want to talk about 3 issues with this study. So I'll start with a quibble. One is the study's definition of lockdowns. It defines lockdowns as all non-pharmaceutical intervention. So that's basically anything that isn't drugs being put into your system, including things like masking. And I would say that even a quite strict masking regime is not quite the same as a lockdown. And so it's good to understand what this study is actually looking at, which is not just strict quarantine or stay-at-home rules. It's also looking at all non-pharmaceutical interventions. One limitation of the study, one reason why I would say it doesn't tell us as much as we would really like it to, is the timing. Many of them are from 2020, right after the virus sort of took hold. The most recent, I believe, is from summer 2021. And so it doesn't account for changes in the virus, the Delta variant or Omicron. And that means that because the virus changes, that means that this study just has some limitations in terms of what it can tell us. And all of those studies studies are sort of taken in particular particular times and particular places, and so those don't necessarily extrapolate to universal rules. And then I have one criticism of this study that I think has just gone way too far, and that I think we should mostly dismiss. And so if you are reading criticisms of this study, it excluded, people are saying that it excluded epidemiological research. So any studies by people who study viruses for a living. That is not quite wrong, but it's not quite right either. What the study did was that exclude all research that compared real-world results with epidemiological models. And so this is one way that epidemiologists study policy is they say, well, look, we can study what happened after they put this policy in place, and then we can study what might have happened according to a projection based on a model. And what this study did was say, we're not going to look at any of those studies in our meta-analysis. Instead, what we are going to do are look at difference in difference studies, where you actually compare what happened in the real world to something else that happened in the real world. Basically, they studied policy changes by looking at actual results, comparing policy changes that happen in the real world to what you might call a synthetic control, right? Because it's very difficult to produce a true control group for a randomized controlled study in public policy. What we end up doing is finding a group that looks an awful lot like the study group, the group that was acted upon with a policy, and saying, well, let's compare those two. Now, there are limitations to that kind of study. It's imperfect. However, it's also quite useful. And in fact, the Nobel Prize in Economics this year was given to some of the originators of this kind of research, just because it has proven so useful and so good at helping us understand policy change in particular. And what that type of study largely replaced was comparing policy changes to economic models, because the models aren't as good as looking at what has happened in the actual real world. And so what we have here is a limited, somewhat tentative, I think, study that shows us policy differences in the real world for non-pharmaceutical interventions. And what it is telling us is that so far, based on research that I think is still somewhat limited and still hasn't sort of isn't definitive, so far it is very difficult to find a meaningful impact for non-pharmaceutical interventions in the real world. And so it's useful enough, even if it is not, I think, the final word on lockdowns and COVID policy.
Catherine, I'm a simple peanut farmer, so I don't understand all this gobbledygook, but it's a Norm Macdonald deep cut there. But it seems to me that it's been kind of obvious since spring of 2020 that non-pharmaceutical interventions are what you do when you don't have vaccines. And you're panicking, and you also aren't paying attention to the real-world studies of things like school shutdowns, and that when you have vaccines, you should knock all that off. What do you attribute the kind of frantic clutching onto the NPI thing in an era where we have vaccination and have had it for now for almost for more than a year available, but certainly 9 months to anyone who wants it?
Yeah, I don't think it was obvious in spring of 2020. I think in spring of 2020, we were like, yeah, I don't know, maybe staying 6 feet apart and wearing masks will work.
Let's say July, now, July 2020.
Yeah, so but what I was going to say is I think that that changes quickly and meaningfully over time. And unfortunately, that fact, which is like just a normal true thing about existing in the world, is now kind of being exploited by people who are doing the science has changed thing. And, you know, I think this study is just one victim of a kind of broader problem, which is that we have this perfect storm of any new study like this Johns Hopkins one is going to be almost totally irrelevant at this point in terms of what people do in the world and what policies they advocate, which is a bummer because everybody got kind of cudgeled with the science right at this moment when we were already in a reproducibility crisis, when we were already worried that the science was like a wet noodle at best. I'm sorry.
Wow.
Matt Welsh has infected
it's
my brain.
It's a virus or something.
We're being beaten with a wet noodle is what I'm saying. And we are not going to...
But like, not Bucatini, right? Because Bucatini is...
No, the Bucatini is unobtainable. Like so it's angel hair. It's even worse. Oh, it's the worst
pasta.
It's
like a cat of nine tails of pasta.
So we're not going to Johns Hopkins study our way out of this problem, I guess is what I'm saying. And I kind of wish we could, right? And obviously this study like matches up with some of my priors, so I'm inclined to be like, seems like a good study. But I think, unfortunately, we are like well out of, maybe very broadly, but certainly with respect to COVID, we are well out of the, we are going to persuade each other with the one new fact, the one new finding. And that maybe over time, a sort of vast accumulation of similar findings will get us there. But by that point, I assume, because doing these types of studies takes time, we will, you know, the situation on the ground will have again shifted so much that either COVID will be fully over in the minds of everyone, including policymakers, or we will be on to a new, different form of the crisis, which will allow the science, but no, my science cycle to continue.
It is almost like the science is an iterative process of argument and discussion that never fully resolves much of anything.
So why don't you put that on a sign?
I'm looking forward to, by the time we finish discussing this, Justin Trudeau is going to be starring in the Dune franchise as Paul, and he'll be the God Emperor of everything. I think, that's the best way to look at it. The reason I'm thinking about Canada right now is that this crisis in science... the book, The Postmodern Condition by Jean Lyotard, he was commissioned by the Quebec government in the 70s to kind of explore why authority was breaking down, like respect for authority was breaking down. And that's where he, said, we live in an age that is characterized by incredulity toward meta-narrative and intense skepticism towards authority and truth claims. And that was back in the late 70s. That is the world we're in. That's the world that Martin Gurry is talking about in a more contemporary context. And so science is helpful because it does actually, it winnows out what is clearly false, but it doesn't necessarily present a positive vision of, okay, this is what we should be doing. And of course, more to the point, it has been so politicized, or it has been recognized as so politicized for so long, and certainly under COVID. Epidemiology and public health, the practitioners revealed themselves as tools of whatever power they wanted to serve, and this was the people who were saying only right-wing scumbags are going out without masks and they're carrying guns everywhere and we shouldn't allow any protests or any gathering of people outdoors, to the next week saying, 20,000 people in a Brooklyn park talking about trans rights for black people, that's not a public health threat. We are living in such an intense moment of politicized science, which is good. It's being red-pilled in the right way, but it makes it harder for any piece of evidence to actually kind of change conversations.
It also puts us in a situation where, we sort of increasingly agree, or many people increasingly agree, that at the very least, it's tough to get to the one true answer. Some people are going kind of full relativist on it, and some people are just like, it's a hard thing. It's always been a hard thing. But that does not take people to a place it could, right? Like one place you could go with that realization that it's really hard to find the one right answer is a pluralist direction. You could say, okay, well, we're just going to have to, make a large space for people to do the best they can given our, limited and fallible humanity. And instead, we seem to just be going like full will to power. It's just like, absolutely. There's no truth, therefore no tolerance, therefore let's just, force our way on people who disagree with us. And we could have chosen the other way.
Well,
I know that this
can.
Is like
we
a preoccupation
can, right?
of conservatives from the 80s and 90s that this was inevitable. But I don't think it was inevitable. It's just we've gone on the wrong branch.
If I may, just to follow up on that and to tie it back to something Matt was talking about, how, good governance was happening at the state level or through governor's mansions and things like that, where the right has power, you are seeing them start to exercise a similar kind of overreach where they, you know, with anti-CRT laws, anti-critical race theory laws, state level laws that are saying in the education system, and, you know, education, K through 12 education is hyper-politicized. It always has been and always will be, but they're saying certain texts, like the 1619 Project, certain concepts, certain things cannot be taught. I mean, they're coming up with gag orders, you know, that will have a massive effect. It's like choking off the internet at a root level or something like that. And so I worry that this is not simply a left wing or a liberal thing. It's, you know, as soon as the right or conservatives get power, they are not going to be like, oh, you know what, we want to live in a world that's kind of weird and interesting and where we let different people live different truths. They have their truth and they're already starting to, you know, kind of apply it in a steamroller fashion where they have power. And this is, if I may say, you know, on a libertarian podcast, this is what the libertarian alternative allows for, right? Like a world where you can actually disagree with people and still live your life and learn from other people and maybe teach them a thing or two.
At the same time, I think political incentives are still having some effect here. In some cases, negatively, but more recently, they have been largely positive, at least in terms of my policy preferences. And, you know, Matt mentioned governors here, Democratic governors who are sort of following the vaxxed and done crowd in Democratic states. And just as we are having this discussion here, it looks like Washington, D.C., where Catherine and I both live, is rolling back its requirement that businesses verify that customers are vaccinated and loosening, or I should say, pulling back on its mask requirement as well. And so that is, you know, following maybe not the science, but following the polls and following where the public is at and following other Democratic governors.
All right, let's get to our end of podcast, what we have been consuming. Catherine, I think you might have a little rage consumption.
I did do some rage consumption. I read, though saying read is generous, Preet Bharara's new book, which is called Justice Is... It is a guide for young truth seekers. And it is dumb as a box of rocks. My God. Preet Bharara, of course, is the jerk face who gagged and subpoenaed Reason during our coverage of the Silk Road trial and demanded our commenters' information, costing us an awful lot of money in legal fees and also an awful lot of rage. Like, I guess you just get to a certain amount of famous and you're just allowed to, like, write a children's book. And, like, somehow that book contract just, like, appears and Preet Bharara must have crossed that threshold. I am a kind of hobbyist consumer of political children's books. I find it to just be, like, a very weirdly compelling genre. But the idea that it's like, oh, you're the former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. Like, definitely what we need from you is an illustrated children's book. Just bizarre to me. Just absolutely bananas. This book is particularly bad because though it is supposed to be for children, it does absolutely not. And it just features kind of a portrait, you know, portraits of fighters for justice, like many of whom are totally uncontroversial. You know, I love me a good inspiring Malala portrait as much as the next gal. You know, Ida B. Wells, sure. John Lewis, let's look at him. He seems cool. Yes, Sojourner Truth. Yep. And of course, everybody's fave, Frederick Douglass, cannot complain. But these people are not introduced in any way. We have no idea who they are. If you are, for instance, a child looking at this children's book, you have no access to anything that is going on. There are just, you know, kind of nice little illustrations by somebody named Sue Cornelison. They seem fine. I don't blame Sue for this book. And then just like ultra generic quotes from this grab bag of figures. You will be not surprised to learn that this book actually ends exactly the same way that Kamala Harris's book that featured her as a superhero ends, which is that the real justice doer is you. So just keep that in mind.
Time Magazine Person of the Year is the kid who bought my book. Nick, what have you been considering?
So lately I've been listening to a podcast called Broken Record, which is mostly interviews of musicians by Rick Rubin, who was one of the co-founders of Def Jam Records way, way back in the day and helped mainstream rap music, along with Russell Simmons, who is somebody who we don't talk about anymore, who, you know, for various reasons, he was a massively and apparently absolutely accurately Me Too'd into a kind of non-existence for the most part. But Rick Rubin has gone on to become a super producer, you know, starting with groups like the Beastie Boys and Run DMC, et cetera, going through the kind of American recordings of Johnny Cash and everything. He's just fantastic. He looks like Howard Hughes now. He rarely wears shoes, maybe tissue boxes on his feet, has a beard that looks like he played for the House of David barnstorming baseball team in the 30s. Fantastic interviewer. He has moved up in the ranks for me of people like Brian Lamb of C-SPAN and John Donvan of Intelligence Squared. He does these interviews with younger and older rock stars, or musicians, really. Recently, the one I listened to most recently was with Steve Van Zandt of, you know, a Bruce Springsteen fame and whatnot. And it's phenomenal because he, like, and Van Zandt towards the end talks about how, like, rock music has returned to the subculture that it was in 1955, and that he, you know, hopes that he'll be able to help keep it alive. He started a couple of XM Sirius stations that really do. Drew Carey, our Reason trustee and friend, is a DJ on one of them. But fantastic. He did an interview with Todd Rundgren about production, mostly about, like, producing other artists. And Rubin is a super producer who does not play any instruments and knows no music whatsoever. And so the way he talks,
he also doesn't even know how to use Pro Tools or any of the basic recording technologies. He just sort of sits in the room and listens.
Yeah. And he, you know, so when he talks to these guys, it's in a kind of fan way, but it's also deeply insightful and appreciative. And the conversation with Rundgren starts in the late 60s, essentially, when Rundgren started recording, goes through current times, and they talk about how, you know, Napster and streaming, early streaming versions were rebuffed explicitly by the record labels, and that gives rise to things. And Rundgren, who was elected into the Rock Hall of Fame but chose not to attend, talks a lot about the way that music has now gone back to earlier versions, where it's about performance. It's not about recording and publishing rights, et cetera. Just fascinating. He also had a great interview with Henry Rollins. That was an amazing, if you care at all about kind of punk and post-punk and the beginning of the DIY movement in a big way in the 1980s. Rick Rubin's, you know, Broken Record podcast is just fantastic. I would also, as an add-on, and I think I presented this months ago, he also did a great interview program on Hulu with Paul McCartney, three parts. That is, you know, Paul McCartney has been interviewed so many times and is so mythologizing of himself. This was a revelation to somebody. Even, you know, I consume all sorts of Beatles shit, and it was the best thing I've ever seen Paul McCartney do. So check out Broken Record with Rick Rubin.
That sounds awesome. Suderman?
I watched Moonfall. It is a stupid movie made by a guy who has been making stupid movies all of his life. I'm speaking, of course, of director Roland Emmerich, who also made movies like Independence Day and Godzilla and 2012 and The Day After Tomorrow. I've enjoyed some of these stupid movies, enjoyed hating many of them as well. They're pleasingly and knowingly moronic. Right. It's just like kind of enjoyable how stupid they are. And occasionally they're also kind of charismatic and charming. Independence Day in particular. They often have a lefty environmentalist bent of some sort. I mean, The Day After Tomorrow and 2012 are explicitly about global warming and you know, sort of environmental destruction. Independence Day has a big subplot about it. But they're also designed as populist crowd pleasers. And so his new one, Moonfall, borrows a lot from the formula that Emmerich has relied on throughout the years, in which a bunch of outsiders and cranks and conspiracy theorists get together with kind of honorable political leaders who are also on the outs from, like, the establishment and who understand that the system is broken to save the day. And so it's kind of an interesting movie to watch here in 22, to just to see how, like a story about how the bureaucrats are inept and don't care for normal people, and the conspiracy theory guy who thinks the moon is actually a superstructure created by aliens to monitor Earth is in fact right. And
spoilers.
Sorry.
Thanks.
But you know, I mean, it's the fact that it is a throwback to his to a formula that worked as recently as the aughts and certainly throughout the 1990s is really sort of telling in terms of how the political winds and sort of what we expect from our heroes has shifted.
There was a great moral panic for about 2 weeks when Independence Day came out and audiences spontaneously cheered when the White House was vaporized by aliens.
That.
Yeah, that was like, oh my God, what have we become?
I bet Newt Gingrich was mad.
I think he was happy because it was a Democrat in the White House at the time, if I'm remembering. But
that's right, because that movie was coded quite clearly as like a lefty political statement. I mean, and I don't think that's wrong to read it that way either.
My darling 7-year-old daughter has been pestering me to take her for a full unfettered day at the Museum of Natural History in New York for a long time, and got it so that that could happen on a recent Saturday, and which was helped greatly by the vaccine mandate, because when it winnowed the crowd, it's usually too crowded there, but it wasn't. Thanks, government authoritarians. But anyways, so we decided just to make it a day where we would not only went there in the planetarium, and museum's still holding up, but more importantly, I went home and watched A Night at the Museum, which I had never seen. The Ben Stiller vehicle. Which he plays the security guard, and then late at night, all the things in the museum turn out to become alive, and the T-Rex is like a dog.
Also, spoilers.
It's okay.
Yeah,
it's been
like
16
years.
So I saw Night Museum 1 and 2 both now. I haven't seen the third. I can only imagine how horrible that is.
I'm hoping for that. The next one is going to be A Night at the Holocaust Museum.
Woo!
You can see the poster already. Come on, it writes itself.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Plenty of shoes to try.
It's kind of hard
exactly.
to
exactly. You just hear the sound at night.
Any thought, but anyways, it's a fun thing to do to go to that museum and watch that movie in the same day, because then it makes you feel happy about seeing things come to life. And it's great if you have a 7-year-old in that thing. And beyond that, it's kind of fun. And there's a lot of Owen Wilson people and Ricky Gervais and Robin Williams, God rest his soul, and other people in there. And it's just sort of a vehicle. But it's the Night Museum 2, which we saw over the weekend, Ben Stiller plays a guy who finally has achieved his dream. Of because he's a would-be like salesman of stupid home tech gadgets, like a glow-in-the-dark flashlight or I don't know what. In the first movie, he's struggling and he's getting his car booted and all this kind of stuff. In the second movie, he's successful. He's got a company. He's got pagers. He's got he's doing an infomercial thing with George Foreman. Like it's all going on. And like the message of the movie is that like all the characters in the museum who he's now become friends with tell him that he's like sold out and that he's like, I can see that you're not happy, man. That's my Owen Wilson. I think it's pretty good. I just think that it's either an absolute cry for help from Ben Stiller, making an ironic commentary about how he has to, after having fulfilled everything that he wanted to do in Hollywood, he just basically has to lash himself to a bunch of character actors, and he's making an ironic commentary, or he's just saying, screw you, I'm rich, because those movies make a lot of money.
That opens up the possibility, Matt, of a conversation about what is the worst sequel of all time, because that... The drop-off is dramatic.
Fletch Lives is unbelievably... Is it Fletch Lives or just Fletch 2? But Fletch 2 is so... The original Fletch is as close to perfect cinema. Speaking of which, you know, God rest another soul, Ivan Reitman left us. So that's a great sadness. Anyways, that's enough sadness and Holocaust jokes for 1 week. I won't be back next week, so good luck with Captain Suiterpants. But listen to us every Monday.
Do we know who our special guest star is yet? Or is that yet to
be
determined?
Tune in to find out.
Exactly. Ooh, right.
So exciting. It's a real cliffhanger.
Go to reason.com/podcasts for all of our tasty offerings, including the aforementioned Reason interview with Dr. Nick Gillespie, Doctor's not the title, and the Soho Forum debate series with Dr. Gene Epstein.
He's a master's, actually. He's a master's.
He's a disco doctor. He's a doctor of dance. Yep. And if you like our stuff in general that Reason does, please consider donating to us. reason.com/donate. Giving levels and such. Okay, thank you. Goodbye.